Uncle Dennis. And we'll start off our second half hour with a rather lengthy commentary. And this was sent to me by someone over the internet, but it is a communique from the N30 Black Bloc and was written by the Acme Collective in early December. Starts off, a communique from one section of the Black Bloc of N30 in Seattle. On November 30th, several groups of individuals in the Black Bloc attacked various corporate targets in downtown Seattle. Among them were, just to name a few, Fidelity Investments, Bank of America, U.S. Bank Corp, Key Bank, Washington Mutual Bank, Old Navy, Banana Republic and The Gap, Nike Town and Levi's, McDonald's, Starbucks, Warner Brothers, and Planet Hollywood. This activity lasted for over 5 hours and involved the breaking of storefront windows and doors and the defacing of facades. Slingshots, newspaper boxes, sledgehammers, mallets, crowbars, and nail pullers were used strategically to destroy corporate property and gain access. One of the three targeted Starbucks and Nike Town were looted. Eggs filled with glass etching solution, paintballs, and spray paint were also used. The Black Bloc was a loosely organized cluster of affinity groups and individuals who roamed around downtown, pulled this way by a vulnerable and significant storefront, and that way by the site of a police formation. Unlike the vast majority of activists who were pepper sprayed, tear gassed, and shot at with rubber bullets on several occasions, most of our section of the Black Bloc escaped serious injury by remaining constantly in motion and avoiding entanglement with the police. We buddied up, kept tight, and watched each other's backs. Those attacked by federal thugs were unarrested by quick-thinking and organized members of the Black Bloc. The sense of solidarity was awe-inspiring. The next section is called The Peace Police. Unfortunately, the presence and persistence of peace police was quite disturbing. At least six separate occasions, the so-called nonviolent activists physically attacked individuals who targeted corporate property. Some even went so far as to stand in front of the Nike Town Superstore and tackle and shove the Black Bloc away. Indeed, such self-described peacekeepers posed a much greater threat to individuals in the Black Bloc than those notoriously violent, uniformed peacekeepers sanctioned by the police. Undercover officers have even used the cover of activist peacekeepers to ambush those who engage in corporate property destruction. And the response to the Black Bloc. The response to the Black Bloc has highlighted some of the contradictions and internal oppressions of the nonviolent activist community. Aside from the obvious hypocrisy of those engaged in violence against black-clad and masked people, many of whom were harassed despite the fact they never engaged in property destruction, there is the racism of the privileged activists who can afford to ignore the violence perpetrated against the bulk of society and the natural world in the name of private property rights. Window smashing has engaged and inspired many of the most oppressed members of Seattle's community, more than any giant puppets or sea turtle costumes ever could. Not disparaging the effectiveness of those tools in other communities, here are 10 myths about the Black Bloc. Here's a little something to dispel the myths that have been circulating about the N30 Black Bloc. 1. They are all a bunch of Eugene anarchists. While a few may be anarchists from Eugene, we hail from all over the United States, including Seattle. In any case, most of us are familiar with local issues in Seattle, for instance, the recent occupation of downtown by some of the most nefarious multinational retailers. 2. They are all followers of John Zerzan. A lot of rumors have been circulating that we are followers of John Zerzan, an anarcho-primitivist author from Eugene who advocates property destruction. While some of us may appreciate his writings and analyses, he is in no sense our leader, directly, indirectly, philosophically, or otherwise. 3. The mass public squat is the headquarters of the anarchists who destroyed property on November 30th. In reality, most of the people in the autonomous zone squat are residents of Seattle who have spent most of their time since its opening on the 28th in the squat. While they may know of one another, the two groups are not coextensive, and in no case should the squat be considered the headquarters of people who destroyed property. Number 4. They escalated situations on the 30th, leading to the tear gassing of passive nonviolent protesters. To answer this, we need only note that tear gassing, pepper spraying, and the shooting of rubber bullets all began before the Black Blocs, as far as we know, started engaging in property destruction. In addition, we must resist the tendency to establish a causal relationship between police repression and protest in any form, whether it involved property destruction or not. The police are charged with protecting the interests of the wealthy few, and blame for the violence must be placed upon those who protest those interests. 5. Conversely, they acted in response to the police repression. While this might be a more positive representation of the Black Bloc, it is nevertheless false. We refuse to be misconstrued as a purely reactionary force. While the logic of the Black Bloc may not make sense to some, it is in any case a proactive logic. 6. They are a bunch of angry adolescent boys. Aside from the fact that it belies a disturbing ageism and sexism, it is false. Property destruction is not merely macho rabble-rousing or testosterone-laden angst release, nor is it displaced and reactionary anger. It is strategically and specifically targeted direct action against corporate interests. 7. They just want to fight. This is pretty absurd, and it conveniently ignores the eagerness of peace police to fight us. Of all the groups engaging in direct action, the Black Bloc was perhaps the least interested in engaging the authorities, and we certainly had no interest in fighting other anti-WTO activists, despite some rather strong disagreements over tactics. 8. They are a chaotic, disorganized, and opportunistic mob. While many of us could surely spend days arguing over what chaotic means, we are certainly not disorganized. The organization may have been fluid and dynamic, but it was tight. As for the charge of opportunism, it would be hard to imagine who of the thousand in attendance didn't take advantage of the opportunity created in Seattle to advance their agenda. The question becomes then whether or not we helped create that opportunity, and most of us certainly did, which leads us to the next myth. 9. They don't know the issues, or they aren't activists who've been working on this. While we may not be professional activists, we've all been working on this convergence in Seattle for months. Some of us did work in our hometowns, and others came to Seattle months in advance to work on it. To be sure, we were responsible for hundreds of people who came out on the streets on the 30th, only a very small minority of which had anything to do with the Black Bloc. Most of us have been studying the effects of the global economy, genetic engineering, resource extraction, transportation, labor practices, elimination of indigenous autonomy, animal rights, and human rights, and we've been doing activism on these issues for many years. We are neither ill-informed nor unexperienced. 10. Masked anarchists are anti-democratic and secretive because they hide their identities. Let's face it, with or without a mask, we aren't living in a democracy right now. If this week has not made it plain enough, let us remind you, we are living in a police state. People tell us that if we really think that we're right, we shouldn't be hiding behind masks. The truth will prevail is the assertion. While this is a fine and noble goal, it does not jive with the present reality. Those who pose the greatest threat to the interests of capital and state will be persecuted. Some pacifists may have us accept this persecution gleefully. Others would tell us it is a worthy sacrifice. We are not so morose, nor do we feel we have the privilege to accept persecution as a sacrifice. Persecution to us is a daily inevitability, and we treasure our few freedoms. To accept incarceration as a form of flattery betrays a large amount of first-world privilege. We feel that an attack on private property is necessary if we are to rebuild a world which is useful, healthful, and joyful for everyone. And this despite the fact that hypertrophied private property rights in this country translate into felony charges for any property destruction over $250. The motivations of the Black Bloc? The primary purpose of this communique is to diffuse some of the aura of mystery that surrounds the Black Bloc and make some of its motivations more transparent, since our mess cannot be. On violence of property. We contend that property destruction is not a violent activity unless it destroys lives or causes pain in the process. By this definition, private property, especially corporate private property, is itself infinitely more violent than any action taken against it. Private property should be distinguished from personal property. The latter is based on use, while the former is based on trade. The premise of personal property is that each of us has what she or he needs. The premise of private property is that each of us has something that someone else needs or wants. In a society based on private property rights, those who are able to accrue more of what others need or want have greater power. By extension, they wield greater control over what others perceive as needs and desires, usually in the interest of increasing profit for themselves. Advocates of free trade would like to see this process to its logical conclusion, a network of a few industry monopolists with ultimate control over the lives of everyone else. Advocates of fair trade would like to see this process mitigated by government regulations meant to superficially impose basic humanitarian standards, but as anarchists, we despise both positions. Private property and capitalism, by extension, is intrinsically violent and repressive and cannot be reformed or mitigated. Whether the power of everyone is concentrated into the hands of a few corporate heads or diverted into a regulatory apparatus charged with mitigating the disasters of the latter, no one can be as free or as powerful as they could be in a non-hierarchical society. When we smash a window, we aim to destroy the thin veneer of legitimacy that surrounds private property rights. At the same time, we exercise that set of violent and destructive social relationships which has been imbued in almost everything around us. By destroying private property, we convert its limited exchange value into an expanded use value. A storefront window becomes a vent to let some fresh air into the oppressive atmosphere of a retail outlet, at least until the police decide to tear gas a nearby road blockade. A newspaper box becomes a tool for creating such vents, or a small blockade for the reclamation of public space, or an object to improve one's vantage point by standing on it. A dumpster becomes an obstruction to a phalanx of rioting cops and a source of heat and light. A building facade becomes a message board to record brainstormed ideas for a better world. After N30, many people will never see a shop window or a hammer the same way again. The potential uses of an entire cityscape have increased a thousandfold. The number of broken windows pales in comparison to the number of broken spells cast by a corporate hegemony to lull us into forgetfulness of all the violence committed in the name of private property rights and of all the potential of a society without them. Broken windows can be boarded up with yet more waste to our forests and eventually replaced, but the shattering of assumptions will hopefully persist for some time to come. Against capital and state, the Acme Collective Peasant Revolt. And here is a disclaimer. These observations and analyses represent only those of the Acme Collective and should not be construed to be representative of the rest of the Black Bloc on N30 or anyone else who engaged in riot or property destruction that day. And I might also add, these are not necessarily the views of Earth First Radio, but I present them in the effort to provide balance to the coverage which you received over corporate radio and television. Let's go back into animal news here. To enhance the rebuilding of depleted stocks of Atlantic swordfish and billfish, the National Marine Fisheries Service is proposing closing some federal waters to fishing for these species. The proposal would establish a year-round closed area in the southeastern Atlantic and a seasonal closure off the western Gulf of Mexico from March 1st through September 30th. The closures would together total about 196,370 square miles. Fishery managers believe closing these areas will reduce bycatch of unwanted and undersized fish and will also help rebuild other overfished species such as bluefin tuna and some large coastal shark populations by reducing fishing for them. Also, the National Marine Fisheries Service will accept public comment on the proposal until February 11th of next year. And a copy of the proposed rules are available at www.nmfs.gov/sfa/hmspg.html. Once again, that webpage is www.nmfs.gov/sfa/hmspg.html. The Center for Biological Diversity and the Sea Turtle Restoration Project filed recently a 60-day notice of intent to sue the National Marine Fisheries Service and the California Department of Fish and Game over the illegal killing of endangered sea turtles and sperm whales by the California drift gillnet fishery. Gillnets, sometimes called drift nets, are fine nets made of monofilament nylon, some stretching as long as 40 miles, some 65 kilometers. The nets are often set across known migratory routes of the targeted fish. The gills of the fish are caught in the fine mesh of the net, as are many other non-target species. The group say the fishery, which targets swordfish and thresher sharks, two species which themselves are facing serious decline, also kills numerous dolphins, whales, seals, sea lions, sea turtles, sharks, and sea birds. Of greatest concern to the groups is the death of a large number of critically endangered leatherback sea turtles in California gillnets. The groups also argue the industry is in violation of the Endangered Species Act for killing protected sperm whales unless the National Marine Fisheries Service and the California Department of Fish and Game place immediate restrictions on the industry such that no endangered sea turtles or whales are killed. The Center for Biological Diversity and the Sea Turtle Restoration Project will bring suit to shut down all gill netting in California. And the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency finalized comprehensive water quality improvements for the South Fork of the Eel River, the Noyo River, and the Van Dusen River in an effort to restore salmon and steelhead habitat. The plans, known as the Total Maximum Daily Loads, TMDLs, identify the amount of improvement in sediment and stream temperatures needed to address the decline of the river's native fish populations. The North Coast region of the California Water Quality Control Board will now begin working on plans to implement the TMDLs, although actions including runoff and erosion management, tree planting, and others are going to be undertaken. The TMDLs are implemented through regulatory pollution control programs and voluntary efforts at watershed stakeholders and landowners. These plans serve as a critical step in helping to revive flagging salmon and steelhead runs in these once thriving watersheds, said EPA Regional Administrator Felicia Marcus. We look forward to working with landowners, business, fisher people, state and local officials, and the environmental community to lessen the impact activities such as logging, agriculture, and road building have on these critical habitats while maintaining a healthy economy. These rivers deserve our best efforts. The EPA has already held comment periods this fall, and the EPA and regional staff board are now working on completing total maximum daily loads for the Navarro River and the 10 Mile River next year and the Trinity River in the year 2001. And Africa's southern white rhinoceros is one of the 20th century's great comeback kids. At the end of last century, the world's second largest land mammal was perched precariously on the brink of extinction. In the 1920s, there were between just 50 and 100 in southern Africa, virtually all in the Umfolozi Game Reserve on South Africa's present-day KwaZulu-Natal province. Today, thanks to intense conservation efforts in South Africa, there are well over 8,000 southern white rhinos, and the animal's prospects for survival into the next century look good. The southern white rhino is one of the most phenomenal conservation success stories in all of Africa, if not the world, according to Clive Walker, a noted conservationist and author. The rise in numbers is startling given their size. The white male rhinos can reach weights of 2,200 kilograms, about 5,000 pounds, and the fact that the gestation period of the animal is 16 to 17 months. By way of contrast, the 15 to 20 northern white rhinos left in the Garamba National Park of the Democratic Republic of the Congo look doomed to extinction as that country's brutal civil war lurches on. And also from South Africa, we read that five Tuli elephants, T-U-L-I, Tuli elephants, remaining in captivity at the African Game Service property, received the gift of their freedom last Thursday as they were returned to the wild following a 17-month-long battle to win their release. The elephants have now arrived in Merikili National Park in South Africa. The five African elephants are among 30 baby elephants captured from the wild in the Tuli area of Botswana during a severe drought in July of 1998. Animal dealer Ricardo Giaza moved the elephants to a facility in Brits, South Africa, where he and his staff were training the animals to live in zoos. Training methods captured on videotape included beatings and deprivation. Public outrage in South Africa and around the world was stirred when video of the beatings was shown on a popular South African television program earlier this year. The National Council of Societies for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, under Executive Director Marcel French, filed animal cruelty charges and fought for freedom for the animals. While the case wound through the South African courts, Gaza exported seven of the elephants to zoos in Europe last winter. The NSPCA cared for the remaining 23 and has found homes for them in national zoos and private reserves in South Africa. The five freed Thursday are the last of the 23 Tuli elephants to be placed back into the wild. These elephants would be in zoos throughout the world today if it were not for the determination of the NSPCA staff, who endured long hours in very difficult circumstances to care for these animals, said Dr. Teresa Telecki, director of the HSUS Wildlife Trade Program. As we enter the next millennium, let the Tuli elephant saga be a reminder to us that elephants are very intelligent and social animals. To tear them away from their families and subject them to chains and beatings merely to entertain us is wrong and should never happen again, said Telecki. Ricardo Giaza's case has not yet been settled, and meanwhile, he is still exporting wild South African animals to zoos and safari parks around the world. On October 5th, a consignment of 167 wild African wild animals from African Game Services was flown to China in a Singapore Airlines 747. The animals range from suricates to endangered wild African dogs and black rhinos. They were intended for Panyu Zhangjiang Safari Park. The NSPCA is extremely concerned about the growing export trade in African wild animals to China, according to French. And conservation groups and governments of Honduras, Guatemala, and Belize are joining forces to save the West Indies manatee, an endangered marine mammal that lives in the lagoons off the Gulf of Honduras, which is shared by three nations. The West Indian manatee is the only completely herbivorous marine mammal. In a single day, a manatee consumes up to 9% of its 3,000 pounds of body weight in wet vegetation, and it spends 5 hours a day feeding. Manatees feed on the edge of seagrass beds because the nearby deeper water areas offer them an escape route. Female manatees begin reproducing at about 4 years of age, and calves are usually born every 3 or 4 years. Only about 150 manatees remain in the Gulf of Honduras, says Will Mejia, executive director of the Toledo Institute for Development and the Environment in Belize. Mejia attended a conference in July when conservation groups, government agencies, and fishermen came together to discuss how they could work together to better protect the few remaining manatees. Mejia says the biggest threats to manatees in Belizean waters are fishermen from Guatemala who slaughter the animals and sell the meat in their own country. His organization, Tide, established boat patrols to deter the killers, but more patrolling is needed. In October, Tide discovered three more slaughtered manatees, Mejia says. Conference participants concluded that Guatemala and Honduras should also patrol their waters. According to Jeanette Denoek and Carolyn Amillion of EADS, conference participants suggested prohibiting the use of huge nets staked out by fishermen to trap and drown manatees. Boat speeds should be regulated as propellers often fatally injure the slow-swimming manatees, they said. And in spite of park guards who patrol protected areas along the coast of Honduras, some fishermen continue to fix nets that can drown manatees. Another threat to the marine mammals is pollution from sugar refineries and other industries in the nearby city of San Pedro Sula. And when black bear populations decline, the usual explanation is loss of habitat. When it seems likely that the bears will be listed as a threatened species, wildlife managers are urged to stop bear hunting. Recent studies demonstrate that loss of habitat usually means nothing more than bulldozing a road or a fire break into a previously roadless area. Bears avoid roads, and a single new road would divide any habitat in two. Wildlife biologist Dr. Michael Payton has been studying bears in the southern Appalachians for more than 30 years. Bait stations in selected locations have provided population data that correlates with road density. Surprisingly, he found that while all bears avoid roads and clearcuts, females are less likely than males to come near a road. Thus, even unmaintained, untraveled logging roads divide forests into tracts, some of which have low breeding potential. Studies of bear behavior in the Rocky Mountains confirm Payton's observations. And most of the 380,000 miles of roads in national forest lands were built for logging access, and when the logging ends, the roads are virtually abandoned. The Forest Service says it would cost $8.5 billion to repair or reconstruct these roads. It would seem good sense economically and environmentally to naturalize useless roads, reuniting fragmented habitats for bears and other wildlife. And we thank the Green Earth Journal for this article. You can contact them at www.greenjournal.com. Well, that's about all the time we have. If you'd like to get news, announcements, or comments from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, here's the address. Send us email, cruzef@cruzio.com. That's cruzef@cruzio.com. Or send your letters, donations, CDs, cassettes, or anything friendly to Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. That's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Be sure to send those announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. If you'd like more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. They're at P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. That's the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. And Earth First Radio is broadcast live on Free Radio Santa Cruz 96.3 FM every Thursday at 8 p.m., or you can listen to Earth First Radio anytime on your computer at the World Wide Web. We're at radioforall.web.net. That's http://radioforall4.web.net. That's radioforall.web.net. You'll need a sound card in your computer, but the software you need is free for downloading at the site. Earth First Radio is being rebroadcast on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. I just found out tonight we're being rebroadcast on the web, too. So if you found us on the web, you can ask your local station to download and rebroadcast Earth First Radio. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney from the CD Keep It Wild. Earth First Radio is affiliated with the Earth First Radio Network. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening, and please tune in again. We're going to check on out of here with a Casey Neal tune called Okanagan County. Like the cascade.
like it's the first time, and the story's getting bloody Steve.